The era of cheap money actually led to a situation where policymakers postponed the most difficult structural reforms that were supposed to take place because suddenly there was cheap money.
With the years of low interest rates now behind us and the effects of climate change and geopolitical tensions getting worse, what does resilience look like?
My biggest worry is that we are better and better at analyzing the problem, but we are not making the urgent response, even on the smaller things that don't solve everything, but they actually make a difference in the near term. And so what can we do to find quick responses?
We cannot wait for a change in the international financial architecture.
I'm one of the people...
This year's customary Per Jacobsen lecture was not actually a lecture, but a discussion about the challenges for emerging markets to build resilience in such uncertain times.
We will all suffer global warming. So can we have a multilateral approach that is fair, that would ensure that the global system becomes resilient?
The talk featured Lesetse Khanyaho, governor of the Reserve Bank of South Africa, and Masoud Ahmed, president of the Center for Global Development. The discussion, held in Marrakesh during the annual meetings, marked the 60th anniversary of the Per Jacobsen series and was moderated by its chairman, Guillermo Ortiz, former governor of the Bank of Mexico and finance minister.
So let me begin it is true that given the multiple shocks that we have been suffering, if you could, just don't want to go through the whole list again, but I mean, we started with the pandemic, supply chain disruptions, then the geopolitical problems, tensions, you name it, the term has been coined as poly shocks, the convergence of multiple shocks in a short period of time, and this is what we're having. So it's true that emerging markets, particularly those in the sort of middle income range, have been pretty resilient. And, it is a little bit surprising that given the magnitude of the shocks, that we have had no major, problems of losing market access, except in a handful of countries. But yet, there are also a number of countries, particularly low-income countries, that are in a much more fragile state. So talking about resilience should not lead to talk about complacency. Because on the other hand, you have the fragmentation. I mean, the report of the IMF mentions explicitly that countries have different fortunes. And in the case of emerging markets in general, the medium-term prospects are pretty dire. And this is apart from the impact of the pandemic in terms of loss of education, school years, the huge increase in poverty, almost 100 million people are more important. The progress made in reducing income disparities has been halted and reversed in many cases. So this is a very mixed and difficult picture. So let me begin with this question. What is your view on this assessment? In terms of resilience, fragmentation, and perhaps we can go on and talk about what's needed, going forward, the role of international organizations and so on. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Guillermo, and thanks for those introductory remarks. When I was asked to be part of this panel, it says building economic resilience in uncertain times, I said maybe this is what we should have asked some 3 or 4 years ago. And so I decided to put my own theme to this discussion. And it's rebuilding economic resilience rather than building one. Because as things stand, the aftermath of the COVID shock meant that the resilience of economies got seriously tested. And I just want to make the first three points, and I'm sure during the discussion we will get to that. What did we learn getting into the crisis? One is that those countries that had policy buffers coped better. And so the same old that you must have prudent macro remained. And so the countries that were within their inflation targets or below them, the countries that had fiscal buffers were able to respond to the crisis through fiscal action and through providing monetary support via the central banks. And I can say that in our region, I mean, my own country didn't have the fiscal buffers. So fiscal couldn't really come to the party. They tried, but they were really scratching on the surface. What we did have, though, were the monetary buffers. Inflation was on target. We still had a positive policy rate, and so we were able to rapidly adjust policy to get into that. Fiscal deteriorated, and which is why it leads me, why I said rebuilding resilience. Because you see, as the global economy reopened in 2021, inflation was starting to rise, and so we had to take steps to deal with inflation. And here, emerging markets were quick off the mark, and the Latin American central banks in particular moved much earlier than those that the rest of us. We only started moving in November to adjust policy, and I think Brazil started earlier in April. So that was the one leg. So the central banks came to the party to provide support during the COVID-19 crisis. They were able to do that to the extent that they had the policy buffers. If you didn't have the policy buffers, it was a completely different story. But the point here was that there were all sorts of things, those which couldn't do policy adjustment in that manner were left in all sorts of trouble. But there were also other things that that got done to the extent that there was market dysfunction. A number of countries started to use tools to reopen markets, and that was a useful thing. But not everybody could do that. Let me just mention fiscal, and then so that I can allow Masood to talk, was that then as the economy reopened, commodity prices were rising, and commodity exporters suddenly had revenue they didn't expect. And once again, it's how they started to use that. Did they use that to rebuild the policy space, or did they go and spend? And I can say from my country that we started the debate. Maybe we shouldn't use this money to rebuild policy space. Maybe we will use a third to rebuild policy space. We will use a third to continue to provide social support. And maybe we'll use a third to go and invest. And the attitude seemed to be that the commodity cycle is on an upswing once again, and it will be with us for a long time. It was not to be. And now we are back in a situation where we are asking the question. We could have built the buffers then, and then we could be using the space. We didn't. So now that is why I said we are going to have to rebuild the buffers. Yeah. Last point, and then we would come back to this, is that during that process, central banks came to the party, and because central banks came to the party, interest rates got depressed, treasuries got addicted to very cheap money, and they thought this was a permanent situation. And as the economies reopened, as inflation resurged, treasuries are finding themselves in an environment where borrowing costs are elevated. But there is another damage that was caused. The damage that was caused was that the era of cheap money actually led to a situation where policymakers postponed the most difficult structural reforms that were supposed to take place, because suddenly there was cheap money. And that is what we face. And the structural changes are going to be crucial. I mean, I think that earlier we had this thing, there would be a billion people under the age of 20 who will be joining the labor market in the next few years. Are we all going to be able to absorb them? Absent structural reforms, we would not be able to.
Thank you, Lecha. Let me take a point that Lecha mentioned, Masood, and you know, ask you the following. Lecha mentioned that this time around, very unusually, it was emerging markets that you know, realized that inflation was not a temporary phenomenon that would just fade away with the restoration of supply chains and so on. So, you know, central banks in Latin America started raising rates almost a year before the Fed. As a result of that, I mean, to me, it's very difficult to understand, you know, why the, you know, the governors of central banks in developed countries did not at least, you know, see what was going on. You know, why are these guys raising rates? Maybe because they have lower credibility and they need to anchor expectations, whatever you name it, no? But the end result is that this tightening cycle has been extremely compressed. I think that we haven't seen, you know, this kind of raises in interest rates, both policy and market interest rates, in compressed in 1 year, or a year and a half, in decades. So this obviously poses a number of challenges for financial stability and so on, but also, as I was saying, for emerging markets, that given the prospect for, you know, slower growth going forward and so on, how do you see this environment?
Thank you very much, Guillermo. And I want to answer your question by building a bit on what Lesetia said. See, I think I like what you started with, which is that we should be calling this rebuilding resilience. But another way I might think about it is that, you know, we've been saying countries need to build resilience. It's a sort of standard line in IMF documents, right? I mean, if you look at Rio's, VO's, we always put in that countries need to build resilience, use their buffers. How is it different now? What are we saying that's different? And I think you just drew a whole lot of lessons, including, I'll come to the point about the lessons that come from the, if you delay in some cases the tightening, then you have to do longer, harder to also make sure the expectations don't set in. And I think Latin American central banks were good at that in the sense. But I think what is different in two ways. One, if you listen to all of what Kristalina, Antoinette, you, your colleagues have been saying, you're saying we are entering into an era where shocks are going to be more frequent and deeper. So COVID was one, food was another, now there are political shocks. So the question then becomes, how does the process of building resilience at the national level and at the international level have to change to take into account this new state in which we are going to try and help build resilience? If there are going to be more frequent shocks, what do you need to do? Well, I think there are two lessons that come to me from that. One is you have to allow for larger and more quickly replenished buffers than you would have done in the past. Because in the past, you might have thought, well, you know, I get a shock, I'll be the only one, I'll find ways to deal with it. Now, if everybody's going to be hit by shocks because they affect more than one country, they come frequently, you need to be able to reflect that in the buffer. Now, that's easier said than done. Because if you're, particularly if you're a cash-strapped, low-income country, you're actually struggling to make the payments every week and every month, then you come along and say you've got to build even bigger buffers. I mean, that's okay, but it's just a reality we have to build into our accounting now. But the second thing is that the decision-making process for reacting to a shock has to be much more agile. And that's, you see, what we saw in the COVID response was that the countries that did well were the ones, or did relatively well, were the ones that had the mechanisms to be able to respond quickly. If you had already in place a digital infrastructure for reaching all large numbers of your households, you could make cash transfers more easily and help them buffer the impact. If you didn't, it was much harder because you were trying to set it up. So I would say the lesson that I draw from the shocks, and by the way, the same applies to the institutions, which is the central banks and the governments, in their ability to respond more quickly to these shocks. So I would say lesson number one is, you know, the size of the buffers probably end up being a bit larger and the processes need to be more agile. But the second thing I would say is it's not just about countries. It's about the international institutions that have been helping to countries to manage their economic and financial stability. Because now if we accept the same line that there are going to be more shocks more frequent, then the natural question is, take the IMF, because you know we're talking about the IMF today, does the IMF have the right kind of facilities and tools to respond to the sorts of shocks we will be seeing more of, rather than to the idiosyncratic country-by-country problem, which used to come mostly because countries messed it up themselves over time on the fiscal or the financial side, and you end up with an imbalance that has to be corrected. IMF has a very good machinery for doing that. But now you get hit by a set of shocks. Does the IMF have the right instruments? So this maybe not, today is not the time to have a debate about what those instruments should be, but I think that's a question that we need to ask. Do the multilateral development banks have a different role to play in a more shock-prone world? That's another question to which I think we need to find an answer. Mm. And last thing I'll say is that, so one kind of resilience we've been talking about is in response to more frequent shocks. But the other way in which resilience is going to be different now is actually building in the ability to cope with predictable worsening of climate-related impact. So climate, there's nothing unpredictable about this, but you know, it's pretty clear, it's happening, it's going to happen more and faster. The question is, how much are we building that in? And it's not just a macro issue. I'll give you a very simple example to close with. If you're building schools or hospitals today, let's say in Africa, your building design was meant to cope with 35 degree summers or 32 degree summers, right? Now the summers are going to be 42 degrees. Those hospital buildings and school buildings, will they be functional when it's much, much hotter outside? See, I think at this stage, in my personal view, I'm happy to be corrected, but my understanding is that if you went and talked to the people who run the schools and the health systems and say, how are you building into your design for future infrastructure the predictable impact of climate change on this environment, you would come away feeling that there's work to be done. So I think the second bit of resilience is now to make a serious, determined, across-the-board effort on building into our systems the consequence of predictable worsening as a result of climate change, which is different from what we have been thinking in the past. Because I think, to be fair, you know, 5 years ago, we haven't internalized what we have internalized now in terms of how predictable and how rapidly we are going to see the effect of worsening climate on us. So we stop with that.
Well, this is a very tall order, Masoud, no? Not only we have to rebuild buffers and do it on a timely basis, as was mentioned, but also take into account the more the frequency of shocks and the overall overriding issue of climate change and the impact of that. So, you have to finance development, you have to do buffers, you have to finance climate change. I mean, you are the central bank, you don't have to do that, but you know, the government has to do that. And obviously, there is a role of international organizations, you know. What can the IMF and the World Bank do? And back in 2008 and 2009, during the great financial crisis, the emergency was there, and action followed. You know, the contingent credit line was put together in a matter of literally a couple of weeks. You know, I had conversations at the outset with the managing director and deputy managing director. So it was put together very quickly. You know? And I don't see the same kind of the sense of urgency and reaction. You know? So this is to deal with short-term problems derived from the shocks. Now, on the question of financing climate change and this super expensive horizon that we have going forward, it's essential that the private sector participates and capital markets. So obviously institutions, particularly the World Bank, have to be taking part of the risk in these projects. Otherwise, it will be very difficult for private capital markets to finance. But anyway, how do you see the role of both IMF and the World Bank and the other multilateral institutions in this problem?
I think that it just links from what Masoud was saying about the role of the global institutions. If one was to ask developing countries all to build buffers, and one of the big shocks that we had was that during the lockdown, countries experienced capital outflows. If you didn't have reserves, you could have easily faced a balance of payment crisis. Now, not all of us can self-insure, so we clearly need a collective pooling of insurance. And those who have heard me say, I have said this a couple of times before. So 2008, global financial crisis, and then we say that we need the IMF to be resourced. The IMF says we need permanent resources. It says, no, you are not getting permanent resources. We are going to give you temporary resources. Gave them temporary resources, and then as we were going through we thought that we have conquered the global financial crisis, and there was a big debate, we should be withdrawing these temporary resources. And we said, no, but the IMF says it needs permanent resources. Enter COVID. It had to take COVID to convince us that we must put more resources into the IMF. Are we going to wait for another shock of that magnitude before we reach an agreement that says that for us to have this collective insurance scheme that many countries that can afford could utilize, that we still engage in a debate about should we be having this? The lesson from COVID had been that we talked about buffers, but we are going to have to build redundancies because we saw it with the global supply chains. And one of those redundancies that we might have to build is resources in the IMF that might not be required now, but we've got to build that redundancy because we do not know when we would actually need that, we will need that redundancy. And this redundancy, sometimes you ask the question, maybe there might be in the private sector, but at the end of the day, this becomes a public good that we are going to have to do. Just a word about climate and climate finance and the choices that you have talked about that we are going to have to finance development, we are going to do this. And then you said not the central banks, which I agree with you. But as treasuries run out of financing resources, they starting to look at the treasury and they're starting to get crazy ideas because they think that maybe these chaps, you know, they have been so good, they could tame inflation. They might just tame our financing problems too. And therein lies the problem, that we might just be looking into institutions that not have not been designed for a particular purpose, but because they have been successful in dealing with inflation, society is starting to have an inflated expectation of what central banks can actually do. And that becomes a risk. And so we're dealing with climate and the just energy transition. I'll use the example of South Africa. South Africa has been offered these resources, $8.5 billion, to finance the just energy transition because our energy is based on coal. And just the biggest chunk of those resources are debt. Now, we are sitting on a debt to GDP of 70%, and you are saying you are offering us resources to do a just transition, and the only resources you can offer us is to pile us with more debt. At the time when we say there is a debt problem, not just in emerging markets, there is a debt problem in the advanced economies. So how are you going to finance the just energy transition by piling countries with more debt? And therein lies the thing, and you said the private sector must be coming in, and it's important then that we look at almost a bigger chunk of the just energy transition being financed through non-debt creating resources. Otherwise, there is no just energy transition. And lastly, that in that climate financing, we have got a difficult conversation to have with societies about this just energy transition when you are faced with the following. So we listened to the Minister of Finance from Germany. He says he has got the most efficient coal-fired power stations, and he's going to have to shut them down and spend money to replace them with something else without adding a single megawatt to his grid. Well, South Africa is having to shut down coal-fired power stations at the time when we have got a shortage of electricity. What conversation do we have with the South African society? What mitigations do you put in place so that they stay on course for that? And if you do not put those mitigations in place, the public could justifiably say, there is no just in this JET, and we are going to have problems. And to complicate matters, as we were shutting down these coal-powered fire stations, Europe was facing an energy shock with the war in Ukraine. And what does Europe do? They say to South Africa, send us the coal. So now we are saying to the South Africans, shut down the coal-powered fire stations. Europe says, send us the coal. And you say, why do you want the coal? It says energy security. What makes European energy security more important than African energy security? So you are having that conversation, and the discourse have got to be a fair conversation that says, we have got one planet. It doesn't help that others are saying, we are not polluting, and you are polluting, and because you are polluting, I'm going to impose some carbon entry tax on the goods that you are saying. We have got one planet. So if we continue, we will all suffer global warming. So can we have a multilateral approach that is fair, that would ensure that not just countries becoming resilient, that the global system becomes resilient? Yep.
Yeah. Well, Masoud, building on this, we talk about climate change and the investment needed. The numbers are mind-boggling. At the time when, as you mentioned, debt levels are in both emerging markets and developed markets are at historical highs by far. The global debt levels are some 30%, 25-30% higher than before the pandemic, and substantially higher than the previous financial crisis in 2000. So, you know, as one example, for example, the World Bank, you know, it's widely suspect that the balance sheet of the World Bank is not being used effectively.
Right.
I mean, the firing power should be a lot greater without being exposing for downgrades or anything. So how do you see the, you know, the risk mitigation part of the project, so we can get the capital markets to finance, you know, the green transition?
Thank you very much. Let me just come exactly to that issue of how can we get the multilateral development banks? What role can they play? Mm-hmm. And let's take the World Bank as an example, but the same thing applies to all the multilateral development banks in varying degrees, the regional banks also. And yesterday, we released a report which is exactly about the role of the multilateral development banks. It's produced by an independent group that's co-chaired by Larry Summers and N.K. Singh on the G20 website. It's on the CGD website. If you want to, you know, take a look at it, it'll go into a lot more detail. But the core point of it, which is what I want to say now, is that for the multilateral development banks, there are really three things that they have to do to respond. The first is that they have to explicitly take on board that it is part of their job to help deal with global challenges, and that should be therefore translated into their business processes so that they're helping countries dealing with climate, with pandemics in a much more systematic way than by an add-on at the moment. You've noticed the World Bank just agreed a new vision statement for itself. It used to be eliminating poverty and shared prosperity. Now it's ending poverty on a livable planet. I mean, these are all words, but the essence of it is to reflect the fact that the livability of the planet is part of what we need to achieve. And they've also, as a result, now got to translate that into what does it mean? It's nice to have the vision, but in practice. Second thing, they have to be able to do this at a much larger scale to have the impact. And what the report is saying is that we should aim for them to be three times the MDBs, to be three times the current size of their operations by the end of this decade. And then the third thing is, well, and how do you finance this? Your question? You can finance about half of the increase from better use of their existing balance sheets and by putting in the kinds of innovative schemes that some shareholders are already doing. The Germans are giving them some extra money as a long-term loan. The US is offering to, wants to get it through Congress, a guarantee that will help them to scale up. So these things will get you halfway. But the other half has to be through an increase in their basic capital. Because without an increase in capital, you're not going to get there. And the third thing is that they have to shift their focus only from what they lend to how they help other private money to come in. And mobilizing private capital, at least as much again as they do now, is part of what they need to do to get to that outcome. So that's the sort of agenda. But the point I want to leave you with, look, the biggest problem we now face is not that we don't know what to do. You know, we have a pretty clear idea of what needs to be done at the country level, at the international level. And at one level, you come into meetings. The higher you go in the food chain, the more the meetings talk about big challenges and you know, the global solutions and the need for global cooperation. This is a discontinuity. This is the moment for us to seize it. But as you start coming down and you look at the people who are actually making the day-to-day decisions in national governments, many of whom sit on the boards of these different institutions, then the degree of conservatism starts to grow. So you might say, at one level, that the IMF should develop a big safety net to help countries deal with shocks. But when the IMF is actually designing that safety net, if history is anything to go by, it will end up being forced more and more to tighten the measures so that, the way I look at it, 80% of the people for whom the safety net is meant won't actually be eligible to use it. because it'll just be for the ones who are very well-managed, tightly run economies. Now, I hope that's not the case, but the basic issue here is a lack of coherence between the recognition of the challenge as being enormous, the recognition of the need to act at scale and in ways that are very different from the past. I mean, JET is another example. If you listen to the rhetoric about JETs, it's one level. But when you come right down to how much grant money is actually coming into instead of the 8.5 billion, you see that by the time it actually gets done, it's slow and it gets whittled down. So the sense of urgency has to run up and down the system and it has to run across the institutions. And I think until we crack that, we will keep going around a bit in circles in terms of more and more eloquent statements about the nature of the problem and the need for collective discontinuity response, but little bit harder to follow through.
Well, on this note, let me bring this panel to a close and thank Masood and Lacha for their comments. And thank you very much for attending.
The 2023 Per Jacobsen Lecture was held in Marrakesh during the annual meetings and was moderated by its chairman, Guillermo Ortiz. The discussion featured Lesetia Khanyaho, governor of the Reserve Bank of South Africa, and Masood Ahmed, president of the Center for Global Development. You can watch a webcast of the entire event at imf.org. You can find more IMF podcasts at imf.org/podcasts or wherever you listen. You can also follow us on X, formerly known as Twitter, at IMF_podcast. Thanks for listening.